and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm John Kiriakou, and I'm joined in studio by co-host Brian Becker. In this hour, we take a look at the breaking news of the day. First, Cesar Sayoc was arrested in Florida today in connection with more than a dozen pipe bombs that have been mailed to prominent critics of Donald Trump. Two more bombs were intercepted today after being mailed to Democratic Senator Cory Booker and former Director of National Intelligence James Clapper. California Senator Kamala Harris may also have received a bomb today. Next, Representative Mark Meadows, a Republican from North Carolina, said following a seven-hour-long closed-door session with former Trump campaign advisor George Papadopoulos that the FBI's Russia investigation was on weak footing from the beginning and that the investigation of Papadopoulos in and of itself was unconstitutional. Papadopoulos told Fox and Friends this morning that the FBI had violated his constitutional rights and that he was considering withdrawing from his plea deal, even though he has already cooperated with the Mueller team and served 2 weeks in jail. Then, 16 years ago today, the U.S. anti-war movement burst onto the scene with a massive protest in Washington, D.C. The focus of the protest was to stop George W. Bush and Dick Cheney from taking the country to war in Iraq. Within a few weeks, that movement became a global anti-war movement, drawing in more than 10 million people. The New York Times in February 2003 called this unprecedented movement the world's second superpower. Today, I'm going to interview my co-host Brian Becker, the national director of the Answer Coalition, the group that initiated these mass protests 16 years ago today. And then an oil spill that has been quietly leaking millions of barrels into the Gulf of Mexico has gone unplugged for so long that it now verges on becoming one of the worst offshore disasters in American history. Between 300 and 700 barrels of oil per day have been leaking from a site off the coast of Louisiana for the past 14 years, since an offshore oil platform sank during Hurricane Ivan. It has never been capped. And finally, it's Friday, so we'll look at the week's worst, funniest, and most misleading headlines. That's all coming up next on Loud and Clear. Now we turn to the controversy over bombs being mailed to prominent Democrats. Cesar Sayoc was arrested in Florida today in connection with more than a dozen pipe bombs that have been mailed to prominent critics of Donald Trump. Two more bombs were intercepted today after being mailed to Democratic Senator Cory Booker and former Director of National Intelligence James Clapper. We're joined from New York by Ted Rall. Ted is an award-winning editorial cartoonist and columnist, and you can check out his work at rall.com. That's R-A-L-L.com. Welcome back, Ted.
Thank you, John.
Ted, I have to state the obvious. This guy just seems like a moron who got caught. He went to the same AutoZone to buy the wiring for every one of these bombs. He left fingerprints all over every one of the bombs and the packaging. And so the FBI just basically flew down to Florida and picked them up. What do you make of this?
All I can say is I hope they didn't fly Spirit Airlines. Spirit Airlines kind of sucks. That might explain why it took so long, though. They have a lot of delays.
That's right.
Yeah, you know, I thought they had fingerprints of pretty much everyone. And this guy had a criminal record, so they definitely had his fingerprints. So one wonders what took so long. I guess the FBI is so short-staffed that they just didn't have anyone available, in midweek to take care of it. So they had to wait till Friday.
There you go. They're busy investigating Russia.
Yeah, this is exactly. It's seems a little bit like shooting fish in a barrel. Not exactly hard. I think anyone could have seen the profile of this in particular individual, if not him particularly. One could easily imagine that this was going to be the result.
Ted, one question here that I think is really the most important one. The attorney general said in his press conference this afternoon that they're charging him with five federal crimes. That's interstate transportation of an explosive, illegal mailing of an explosive, threats against former presidents and certain other persons, threatening interstate communications, and assaulting current and former federal officers. That altogether carries a maximum of 58 years. Why aren't they charging him with terrorism?
Well, that's a good question. I think, the definition of terrorism is an act of violence or threatened violence that's meant to elicit a political result. And I think this seems like pretty obvious that that's the intent here. Perhaps they could add that charge later, maybe. But it seems like terrorism should be on the agenda. But that happens a lot. There's a general reticence to charge white guys with terrorism. Mm-hmm. There was kind of a rush to judgment after the Oklahoma City bombing. to pin that on brown-skinned Muslim people when it turned out, in fact, to be a white supremacist and a member of a right-wing militia.
Yes.
And that kind of thing happens a lot. It's an unfortunate sign of, I think, the systemic racism. What I want to know is why there's no special charges for trying to bomb a great treasure of American cinema like Robert De Niro. But
one other funny thing to me, well, it's probably not funny, but at the press conference, the attorney general was asked why Democrats were the targets. And he said, quote, "I don't know, other than what you might expect. He appears to be a partisan." What do you make of that in light of the fact that his van was completely covered in Trump stickers?
Yeah. I think the political motive here isn't hard to discern. To me, it's the fact that George Soros was the first bomb victim or alleged would have been victim identified sort of told the whole thing. I mean, you know, one of the worst things about George Soros is he's really not nearly as far left as on the right think. But I would love it if he were. I mean, you know, those of us on the real left could really use those billions. But he is the bête noire on Fox News and on Breitbart and a bunch of other right-wing venues. And and supposedly he's behind every left-wing or liberal or progressive demonstrator or Me Too or everything that the right hates. And so when I heard that it was Soros, I thought, okay, well, this is one of those people. It has to be.
You know, I think I don't want to get too far off the subject, but I have to agree with you on Soros. You know, when I was arrested after blowing the whistle on the CIA's torture program, I actually went to one of Soros's representatives and I asked if Soros would weigh in for me with the president and ask him to commute my sentence. And the response was, oh, no, Soros doesn't want to touch that issue. He's with Obama. Well, I never thought Obama was a progressive. So there it is. I don't think Soros is anywhere near the far left that the Republicans would have you believe. But anyway, with that said, the next thing in this process is this guy, Cesar Sayoc, is going to be arraigned. He'll probably be indicted after that. He doesn't necessarily have to be indicted, but it will give the investigators a little bit more time to build their case. Looks like they pretty well have a case against him already. And then he'll either take a plea or go on trial. He'll probably take a plea. Now, you mentioned that he has a previous criminal record. There also seems to be some indication that he has some mental illness. I wonder if that's going to play at all into the way this progresses, in that is he going to get some kind of consideration time-wise? Is he going to go to a mental hospital or to a mental facility in the prison system? These are questions we just don't have any way of knowing the answers to yet. But I wonder if the guy, rather than being an idiot, which is how I started this segment, maybe the guy is mentally ill and he's been influenced by all this TV news.
Well, I mean, we're speculating, but I think there's good cause for that speculation. This is a guy who lived in a van. Okay, he's got a number of problems that seem to point to mental illness. Look, if we lived in a sane country, pun completely intended, someone who is mentally ill would not be treated through the criminal justice system, and they would not even be facing the prospect of being locked up in a mental ward inside a prison.
They'd get treatment.
They would get treatment. That's what people who are mentally ill need, treatment, the same way that people who have cancer need an oncologist. But we're so far away from that in this country. It's nuts, pun intended.
Yeah, I wonder if we'll ever get there, frankly. And we see this all the time. You know, let's look at Squeaky Fromm, who took a shot at Gerald Ford back in the mid 1970s. Squeaky Fromm was mentally ill. She was a part of the Manson family, for heaven's sake. And she was trying to shoot Gerald Ford, she said, for Charlie. And instead of putting her in a mental institution, which is where she belonged, they put her in a maximum security women's prison. And she was there for the next 30 years. We can say that about
it's a miscarriage of justice.
Yeah, that's right.
I mean, just like John Hinckley as well. I mean, John Hinckley thought that, you know, he was doing it for Jodie Foster and that she wanted him somehow.
Yes. He was trying to impress her by shooting Ronald Reagan.
Exactly. And now John Hinckley my understanding is that he's got supervised visits. He's out of prison, like, I think 5 days a week. And guess what? He hasn't shot anyone.
No.
Right?
So, no. Imagine.
You know, that's the way to treat it. They should have treated it that way from the beginning.
He lives most of his time with his mother in Williamsburg. And he spends the day sitting at the Starbucks in Barnes & Noble down there. He's not done anything to anybody.
Right. He's harmless. I mean, it's hard for people to understand that someone can do something once, freak out, but not be a general harm to society.
Absolutely true. And I wonder how this is going to play out. There was a case in Florida, quite a famous case, related to the death penalty. There was a woman there who had committed murder. She pleaded not guilty. She was tried and sentenced to death. And over the course of whatever it was, the 15 years that she was in prison, she became a born-again Christian and was genuinely remorseful for what she did. And what she did from death row was to counsel other prisoners who were not on death row, who were eventually going to get out, and try to turn them away from their lives of crime. This was documented over the course of years, and then she was executed.
As I recall, that happened under the Bill Clinton administration.
Yes, that's exactly right.
He refused to pardon her because he, as a Democrat, he felt like he needed to look even tougher on crime than Republicans. And, you know, I think we're moving in the opposite direction. We're regressing as a society in that field. I mean, you know, a penitentiary was a 19th century term. It comes from the word penitent. And the idea was that that people could be reformed, they could be redeemed, that they weren't defined necessarily by the single worst action of their life. And, you know, most criminal justice systems in the world, and I'm talking about a wide range, whether you're talking about from the Scandinavian countries to even China, have that view that people can be redeemed and reformed and brought back into society. Not all of them, but some of them.
Absolutely right. We will leave it there. We were happy to have our friend Ted Rall join us from New York. Ted is an award-winning editorial cartoonist and columnist, and you should check out his work at Rall.com. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll take a short break and come back with a lot more.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou in studio with my co-host Brian Becker. Representative Mark Meadows, a Republican from North Carolina, said following a 7-hour-long closed-door session with former Trump campaign advisor George Papadopoulos that the FBI's Russia investigation was on weak footing from the beginning and that the investigation of Papadopoulos in and of itself was unconstitutional. Papadopoulos, meanwhile, told Fox and Friends this morning that the FBI had violated his constitutional rights and that he was considering withdrawing from his plea deal even though he has already cooperated with the Mueller team and served 2 weeks in jail. We're joined from New York by Daniel Lazar. He's a journalist and author of 3 books, The Frozen Republic, The Velvet Coup, and America's Undeclared War. And we're joined here in the studio by Sputnik News analyst Walter Smolarek. Welcome back, guys.
Thanks for having me.
Daniel, I'm wondering, is this a tempest in a teapot, or does this have real implications? We have no idea what Papadopoulos said to the House Oversight Committee yesterday, but he was in there for 7 hours, so presumably he had a lot to say. But now he's threatening to withdraw.
Well, I don't know about the withdrawal threat. I mean, that sounds kind of far-fetched to me. But Papadopoulos is a very important guy. I mean, he is the one whose words apparently was the start of the investigation, the words that launched the Russiagate investigation. So the sequence of events that led to his conversation with the Australian ambassador that triggered the FBI inquiry is very important because it brings us to the heart of the question of how the investigation got started, what it's about, what really triggered it, and whether everything is really on the up and up when we talk about the origin of this whole crusade.
Walter, that's really it right there. We've got two things that could have been the start of this entire case. One, we all know that Papadopoulos spoke to the Australian ambassador in London and that the Australian ambassador went to his government went to the FBI, and the FBI began this investigation. But we also know that there was a piece of phony intelligence provided to John Brennan by the Estonian intelligence service saying that there was a Russian mole inside the Trump campaign. The FBI believed that to be Carter Page. It wasn't Carter Page. And despite the fact that the intelligence was phony, the feds were able to get this FISA warrant against Carter Page in the campaign renewed 2 or 3 more times. So it seems that we ought to be pretty certain by now that there really wasn't much to this from the very beginning. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's sort of two narratives about who Papadopoulos is. I mean, on the one hand, there's the people who, you know, are sort of like zealots of the Russiagate investigation. And they say, oh, Papadopoulos was this important foreign policy advisor, blah, blah, blah. But then there's the people who are, you know, who are actually running the Trump campaign. And so they say, look, I mean, we hardly know who this Papadopoulos guy is. It seems more likely to me that he's, I mean, it really seems like he's just sort of a young, ambitious, not too smart person who, you know, was just talking too much, but didn't have anything at all to actually back up this sort of like idle chat. And I think in a bar, right, is where he talked to that Australian.
Yeah, it was in a bar.
Yeah,
that's right.
So, I mean, that's kind of where I think it's going.
Daniel Lazar, the Democrats are painting Papadopoulos as a convicted liar. He took a felony plea to making a false statement to the FBI. The Mueller team says that his false statement impeded their investigation for a number of weeks and stopped them from interviewing a professor who was important to the investigation. Jamie Raskin, who's a Democratic congressman from Maryland, said that this whole thing, this whole day with Papadopoulos was, I love this quote, it's a footnote to a sideshow of a wild goose chase. And that one must, quote, take Papadopoulos's testimony for what it's worth, unquote, intimating that it was worth quite little. So has this just broken down into a partisan issue? Is there anything more than that still going on?
Yes, I think there is. I mean, I think this is very important. I think Papadopoulos is the key to this whole operation. We don't really know how this thing got started. All we know is that beginning in mid 2016, the wires were crackling with reports from Eastern Europe, the Baltics, et cetera, about Russian penetration. Papadopoulos says that he was approached in a period of weeks by a half dozen or more mysterious guys, Stephen Halper, Joseph Mifsud, Andrew Downey, et cetera, all trying to sort of probe him about the Russia connection. And he doesn't really know what it was all about, but apparently these forces were converging. And then, of course, there was the famous report by the British ex-MI6 agent, Christopher Steele, alleging a Russia connection. So all these forces were converging sometime in mid-2016, all preaching the same line that there was an all-out Russian effort to penetrate the campaign and to swing it to Trump. So we don't know where this came from, but all we know is that a major investigation was launched, and one which dominated the headlines for 2 years, and really, in a very serious way, destabilized the Trump administration and Washington politics in general. But it's all very mysterious. It looks like some kind of intelligence operation. I don't want to get paranoid. I don't want to go off on some kind of flight of fancy here, but that's the way it looks. And so I think that Papadopoulos is terribly important. And by the way, also, I think that Papadopoulos himself is also, there are a lot of questions about his role, too.
Yeah. Well, I want to ask you a follow-up to that. Papadopoulos told the committee that he was a patsy for a Russian conspiracy. Those were his words. And the Washington Post says today that while Meadows and other Republicans didn't use that same kind of language, what they are suggesting is that the FBI actually violated Papadopoulos's constitutional rights. But what does that mean? What did the FBI do that would have violated Papadopoulos' constitutional rights?
Allegedly, they failed to inform the FISA court about exculpatory evidence that apparently Papadopoulos told them that he had never made any contact, never made any outreach to the Russians, that he had done nothing in order to facilitate any kind of Russian contact whatsoever, and that the FBI failed to pass this along to the FISA court. And that's exculpatory evidence, which the FISA court should have known about, should have been told about, but the FBI didn't.
Walter, that is exculpatory evidence. If information like that, if evidence like that were presented in any other case, I mean, that pretty much would have been the end of the case. That's not what happened here. The FBI kept it to themselves. They didn't tell the court. And as a result, the court didn't tell the defense or the Justice Department, the FBI didn't tell the defense. And so we've got this, you know, 18-month-long practically criminal case. And I can only imagine what Papadopoulos's legal bills must be like or Carter Page's legal bills. I mean, this has gone on twice as long as my own case, and I spent over $1 million. This has to be breaking people.
Yeah, and, you know, I think that the reason that, you know, maybe Papadopoulos is talking about rescinding his agreement with the government is that, you know, as these details come out, it becomes more and more possible to sort of go on the political counteroffensive, whereas in the beginning, I think people were kind of paralyzed by just like the shock of it, right? Just the avalanche of all these extremely, extremely serious allegations. And so the motivation to make a plea deal is much greater in that type of atmosphere than the one that's kind of developed, you know, I don't know, maybe in the last 6 months or over the course of the last year even, where, you know, the forces that are basically fundamentally opposed to the Mueller investigation or are targeted by the Mueller investigation are sort of able to, you know, stand up for themselves a little bit more than they were before.
Daniel Lazar, you mentioned Steve Halper and Joseph Mifsud a couple of minutes ago. We know from Papadopoulos's attorney that Papadopoulos was prepared. Indeed, he was offering to talk about his interactions with Steve Halper and Joseph Mifsud and Downer and a whole bunch of people. The Washington Post says that he offered to talk about 9 individuals. Why is that important? Where should we think the investigation is going, knowing that he was talking about these people?
Well, because Mifsud is especially important because the press has tried to portray him as some kind of Russian agent. But clearly he had very strong ties to Western intelligence, British, Italian, and U.S. intelligence. So he's one of a number of people with ties to U.S. intelligence who are approaching Papadopoulos, probing him, and trying to somehow, you know, lure him into saying something about a Russian connection. And so, you know, these figures, Michael Dearlove, Christopher Steele, they all had connections with British or U.S. intelligence. So it seems that all these connected people were trying to push this line at this point of time.
We'll leave it right there. We were joined from New York by Daniel Lazar. He's a journalist and author of 3 books, The Frozen Republic, The Velvet Coup, and America's Undeclared War. And we were joined in the studio by Walter Smolarek. He's a producer of this show and Sputnik News analyst. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
And clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
15 years ago today, the U.S. anti-war movement burst onto the scene with a massive protest in Washington, D.C. The focus of that protest was to stop George W. Bush and Dick Cheney from taking the country to war in Iraq. Within a few weeks, that movement became a global anti-war movement, drawing in more than 10 million people. The New York Times in February 2003 called this unprecedented movement, quote, the world's second superpower, unquote. Today, I'm going to interview my co-host, Brian Becker. He's the national director of the Answer Coalition, the group that initiated those mass protests 15 years ago today. Brian, I think a lot of people don't know about your work with the Answer Coalition. To tell you the truth, I've always been amazed at your ability and the ability of the Answer Coalition to organize protests, but 10 million people in the streets had to be a shock even to you.
Right. So let me just help people understand why this was different. There have been anti-war movements in the past, but this one was different from earlier anti-war movements, and not just in the United States, but internationally. I want to explain, if I could, why this anti-war movement started with such huge numbers before a war started. Usually an anti-war movement takes off when the country is mired in an unwinnable war or is being defeated. But this was a mass movement before the war. And I want to talk about why that happened and then suddenly how it became not just an American movement, but a global movement.
I remember when this began, we were really charging ahead toward a war of choice against Iraq. The Iraqis were no threat to the United States. The Iraqis were not planning an invasion of any neighboring country as they had done in 1990. This was a war that we decided we wanted to do. It was a war of choice. Everybody knew that this war was coming. Why do you think the government, especially here in Washington, or really governments all around the world, didn't anticipate the level of grassroots opposition to yet another armed conflict?
Well, that's an interesting question, John. And if they hadn't anticipated it, which I think they didn't, they certainly were aware of it once it took off. I mean, today, 15 years ago, October 26, 2002, the Answer Coalition decided to, just 5 weeks earlier, to not have local demonstrations all over the country, but to have one big national protest because it had become clear to us after the summer, after Labor Day, that the Bush administration was racing towards war in Iraq. It wasn't just like a plan for some time in the future. They were on like a complete 100% accelerated path towards war. And so we changed our plans. We said everybody has to come to Washington, D.C. I had been in Congress. I had gone to Congress. I met with and talked to Dennis Kucinich, Barbara Lee, as did other anti-war organizers. We could see that the anti-war messaging into their offices, all the congressional offices, was 300-1 against a war.
Mm-hmm.
And yet we also believed that Congress would capitulate, which, of course, they did. So we said, look, the only thing that can stop this war is for millions of people to come into the streets, and let's do that. Let's show that the people of this country and the people of the world don't want it. So we called this demonstration, and I have to tell you, many liberal and progressive people wouldn't even endorse the demonstration that Answer called at first because they said, that's not going to work. Street protests are outdated. That's something from the 60s. We're going to rely on Congress. We have to lobby Congress. And we said, that's a dead end. Mm-hmm. Congress is going to capitulate. The only way this could possibly be stopped is to change the political climate by bringing people into the streets. So within 5 weeks, and to the shock of everyone, because the Answer Coalition didn't have a lot of resources, we weren't well connected to the donor community, 200,000 people assembled at Constitution Gardens right next to the Vietnam Veterans Memorial. Our message was, unless we stop this war, there's going to be another memorial built, and we don't want to have 15 years, 10 years, whatever number of years later, another wall where thousands of Americans' names appear for a war, as you put it, of choice, meaning a war of aggression. And even more so, millions, perhaps, certainly hundreds of thousands of Iraqis will die. We have to do that. So on October 26th, we had 200,000 people come out. Now, how did that happen in 5 weeks? Partly there was a new era of mass organizing because the internet had become a thing. We were suddenly able to communicate instantly with people around the country rather than the long, slow, tedious, you know, slow should be the primary emphasized word here of traditional grassroots organizing, because you couldn't communicate with people around the country or around the world, and the mainstream media wouldn't cover us. But we used the internet as an organizing tool. When that happened, when 200,000 people came out, anti-war movements in Europe, in the Middle East, in Asia, in Latin America said, oh my God, the American people are starting to move. We oppose this war. We, you know, people in Europe or in other continents, and they started mobilizing.
And it took on a life of its own.
Yeah. So by January 18th, Answer had a follow-up rally here in Washington, D.C. The demonstration was called by the Washington Post the biggest anti-war protest since the Vietnam War. 500,000 people came out and filled up the mall. And we marched to the U.S. Navy Yard, and we had all of the organizations, all of the progressive political and social and religious organizations coming together. And then the next month, on February 15, 2003, the biggest anti-war day in human history, bar none, took place. We had more than, not we, but all the anti-war organizers had more than 10 million people in every capital of the country, of every country almost. In Alaska, Eskimo villages, you know, that had 100 people, 30 of them came out and were having anti-war protests. It was everywhere.
And in fact, that had a major impact, especially in Europe. You know, the United States, I was in the CIA at the time that this was happening. And at the CIA, the leadership there just assumed that our NATO allies were going to fall into line. They were going to endorse the war. They were going to send troops, even if those were just, you know, ambulance drivers or something. And that didn't happen.
Exactly.
What happened was they saw these demonstrations. These demonstrations were taking place in their own countries. And one by one, they decided that they didn't want any part of this war.
Yeah. So the United States couldn't get authorization from the United Nations. Then it couldn't get authorization from NATO. Couldn't use the fig leaf of NATO. So then George W. Bush created something called the Coalition of the Willing.
Mm-hmm.
And that included, at first, the United States, Tony Blair, George W. Bush's poodle, and the Spanish government. But then the Spanish government was toppled because the people in Spain, of course, were out in the millions against the looming war. So it was really just Britain and the United States and a few other tiny countries. And of course, Israel would support it, but they had to be kept in sort of a low-key offstage position. So it didn't look like a war for Israel. So George W. Bush and Cheney called their new international multipolar thing the Coalition of the Willing, which we called the Coalition of the Bribed and Coerced, mm-hmm. because it was just small countries who couldn't stand up to them. And frankly, just the United States and Britain. No international legitimacy at all.
Absolutely. That's exactly how it played out. But then something else happened that I think even after all these years, we don't have an answer for. Once the war broke out, this mass movement kind of went away.
Yeah, it's a very interesting, very telling, very educational thing as to what happened. Public opinion was on our side up until about a week or two or maybe 3 weeks before the invasion. Then it divided. And then by the time U.S. troops were sent into combat, every media outlet, including those that had been skeptical about the looming war of aggression, or as you put it, the war of choice, they all got behind the American troops. We have to defend our boys in combat. That was the basic message. And of course, at the beginning of every war, there is a war hysteria. And this war hysteria basically overtook the country. And then George W. Bush and Rumsfeld and Cheney militarily decided to have this blitzkrieg attack on Baghdad. Fast, nimble, militarily, not that many troops. Ultimately, that became a military problem. But they were able to conquer Baghdad in 3 weeks because, frankly, Iraq's army had already been, and Iraq as a country had been devastated.
That's right.
So then George W. Bush could go on TV and say, see, we did it. We toppled the dictator. We toppled Saddam. And for a moment, the anti-war movement's support declined, and George W. Bush got all these kudos, mm-hmm. including from his critics within the mainstream media, who said, okay, we were doubtful, but it succeeded. But what they didn't anticipate, but we did, because Answer Coalition had a demonstration 3 days after the fall of Baghdad, which was April 9th, 2003. We had a demonstration of now much smaller, 30,000 people on August 12th. And our slogan was, occupation is not liberation. The Bush administration was calling this the liberation of Iraq. We mm-hmm. said, guess what? Iraqis, like any people, but especially Iraqis, are not going to feel good about being occupied by a foreign power, a Western power, a non-Muslim country, and that the Iraqis would, in fact, go into opposition, into resistance. And that's what came next. Instead of it being this quick victory, it was a terrible debacle, a cruel debacle, a humanitarian disaster for Iraqis and for all those American service members who were sent to kill and be killed people by people they don't know, a culture they didn't understand. It was a catastrophe of all types.
And I can tell you that inside the CIA, we even recognized that. And the war was called, in the halls at the CIA, the war was called the big lie. And it was because Dick Cheney et al. Tried so hard to tie Iraq to Al-Qaeda, to the 9/11 attacks, to a whole bunch of different terrible things, weapons of mass destruction. It was all a lie. They were all meant to be pretexts for an invasion. They got their invasion. And it bogged down just like everybody thought it would.
I just want to take us out, John, on this point. You're absolutely right. It was based on a lie. The lie was that Iraq posed a great danger to its neighbors and even to the United States, that it had weapons of mass destruction. None of that was true. Those of us who paid attention to Iraq, which I had for 20 years before that, knew Iraq did not have weapons of mass destruction. It was the most inspected country in the world. It was surrounded. It had been the victim or the target of economic sanctions imposed by the United Nations at the direction of the United States. Millions of Iraqis, or at least more than a million, had died. The country was hobbled. It posed a danger to no one. So it was based and premised on a lie. After the fact, the people who lied to Congress, who lied to the people who are responsible for this terrible crime, and that's what the Iraq War was, mm-hmm. and Iraq is still not recovered. ISIS didn't exist before the Iraq War. All of that, those people are going around making speeches, selling their books. They haven't been, held accountable for what I consider to be war crimes and crimes against humanity for this war of aggression. The Middle East is still living with it. So is the United States.
And as more time passes, I think there's less and less of a chance that anyone will ever be called to account. That was our own Brian Becker. He's the national director of the Answer Coalition. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou in studio with my co-host Brian Becker. An oil spill that has been quietly leaking millions of barrels into the Gulf of Mexico has gone unplugged for so long that it now verges on becoming one of the worst offshore disasters in American history. Between 300 and 700 barrels of oil every day have been leaking from a site off the coast of Louisiana for the past 14 years, since an offshore oil platform sank during Hurricane Ivan. It has never been capped. We're joined from New York by Scott Edwards, co-director of the Food and Water Justice Project at Food and Water Watch. Always good to have you, Scott.
Thanks. Thanks for having me on again.
Scott, when I first read this, I thought, no, this can't be right. It has to be a mistake. And so I Googled it, and sure enough, it's not a mistake. This thing has been leaking oil in the Gulf of Mexico for 14 years. You've told me that there was actually a lawsuit about this. Can you explain?
Yeah, this leak started in 2004. No one knew about it for the first 6 years. It was just not on anybody's radar. You know, ironically, it came to light that there was something going on with this Taylor oil platform. Deepwater Horizon started and happened that catastrophe in 2010. And as they were trying to contain and address the Deepwater Horizon, it came to light that there was this other ongoing spill. And in 2012, both local and a national environmental organization ended up filing a lawsuit against Taylor for the spill, for the damages that were being caused. And that case went on for about 3 years to 2015 and was settled. It was a settlement agreement. The settlement agreement's online. You could read through it. And it, you know, there's provisions in the settlement agreement that talk about Taylor having to disclose any confidential documents that they had related to the spill and what was going on, and conduct a workshop, a one-day workshop, and then pay, I think it was, $400,000 to buy boats and some equipment, but no requirement that they stop the spill. And to date, the spill is still, as you say, ongoing.
And how do you clean something up that has been leaking for 14 years? I mean, the oil's dissipated literally everywhere, even though there's still quite a long streak. But how would you even go about cleaning the water up?
Well, at this point, you can't. I mean, what you do have to do, though, is stop the leak. And so that's the first thing, is to stop the source of the leak. And I think Taylor's been arguing that there is no leak. You know, their position's been, well, this is just oil coming up through sediment that's containing oil, which is nonsense. They don't want to spend the money. It's all about money, right? These oil companies don't want to spend any of their huge profits to go down there and fix these problems. So you have to stop the leak. But yeah, at this flow rate, you know, somewhere up to 30,000 gallons a day, it's just leaking year after year after year. And it quickly flows out into the Gulf. And there's no way to really clean it up. You can't put this stuff back in the pipeline, that's for sure.
Explain to us also what kind of damage a leak like this would cause. Now, 300 to 700 barrels doesn't sound like a lot, but over this extended period of time, it must be having an effect on the environment, on fish, on shellfish, on other wildlife.
Oh, absolutely. The impacts of fossil fuel oil leaks on marine life is well documented. I mean, this, as you say, you know, it's so much a day. This is projected over the next few years of surpassing the 175 million gallons of oil that came out of Deepwater Horizon. And we saw the devastation that oil spill caused to wildlife and aquatic life. So we're talking about a leak of that size, fairly imminent, coming out of Taylor with lots of the same types of impacts, you know, oil, toxin for marine life. And so we are ongoing poisoning the Gulf as we speak, or Taylor is, at least.
You know, we should remind people, too, we eat the shrimp, we eat the fish, we eat the kelp, we eat everything else that's coming out of this. And these animals in the food chain, are carrying oil and oil products and heavy metals. Now, you said that the company said that it was a naturally occurring leak. That's ridiculous, of course. We know from the scientists involved in following this issue that this oil platform toppled in a mudslide, an underwater mudslide that was caused by Hurricane Ivan, and they just decided they were going to get out of it with as little work as they possibly could.
Yeah, I mean, I think that what they're claiming is they the leaks have stopped, and what we're seeing now, the ongoing discharges, are the oil that leaked before settling into the sediment. And when you get tidal shifts and storms coming in, the sediment gets shaken up and the oil gets released out of the sediment. There's simply no way that could explain the, you know, up to 30,000 gallons a day that are coming up out of that site. So, yeah, and so they just don't want to spend the money to go down there and fix this problem.
And what's the Interior Department doing? There was a piece in the Washington Post today talking about Interior and Energy both planning to expand leases for oil and gas, even in the area of this spill. It would be the largest expansion in American history for oil and gas exploration.
Oh, yeah, certainly. I mean, I think we've discussed this before. Is this administration is hell-bent on oil and gas development at any cost. This administration, this EPA, certainly won't look at what's happening in the Gulf now and this leak with any sort of gravity, with any sort of concern. This is the cost of the fossil fuel industry and expanding it. So yes, they are expanding drilling in the Gulf. While they're expanding drilling, they're also pulling back on any safety regulations, environmental assessment programs. They're streamlining all these processes to make expansion easier. So we will see more Taylor oil spills. We will see more Deepwater Horizons under this administration with the expansion and the loosening of regulations.
In fact, this expansion would include the Atlantic coast. And there hasn't been drilling along the Atlantic coast in more than 50 years, at least according to the Washington Post. And at the same time, hurricanes hit the Atlantic coast twice as often as hurricanes hit the Gulf Coast, Florida, Louisiana, Alabama, Mississippi, and Texas. It's that much more dangerous, 100% more dangerous.
Right. There's been a big push to develop off the Atlantic coast, except, you know, and Trump, again, has been pitching this ever since he took office. It's funny to hear, though, when you get people like the Republican governors of states like Florida asking Trump not to do it, then Trump seems to be willing to give a waiver to his Republican friends for offshore drilling. We'll see if that holds up. Of course, if that's a Democrat sitting in the governor's house in any of these states, they won't get a waiver. So it's a recognition, right, that even on the Republican side, that this type of activity is hugely damaging to the environment, and the governor of Florida doesn't want his tourism industry interfered with because he knows what a spill will do. Yet, you know, they're willing to let it happen in other places as long as it's not their state.
I just want to talk in generalities about the Gulf of Mexico. I'm looking at this Washington Post piece that appeared this morning. It says here, on average, 330,000 gallons of crude are spilled each year in Louisiana from offshore platforms. 330,000 gallons every year. The Gulf is one of the richest and most productive oil and gas regions in the world, and it will yield 600 million barrels of oil this year alone, which is 20% of all U.S. oil production. Another 40 billion barrels rest underground waiting to be recovered. There are 2,000 oil platforms just off the coast of Louisiana, just Louisiana. Another 2,000 lie off the coast of Texas and Mississippi. And on top of that, there are 50,000 miles of active and inactive pipelines carrying oil and minerals to the shore. So I'm going to assume your response is going to be yes, but should we expect more spills like this?
Oh, it's inevitable. I mean, as long as this industry operates, there are going to be spills, even under the most protective regulations. And as I said, we're moving ahead away from protective regulations. So the amount of spills we're seeing now will just get worse. And as with the Taylor spill, how many are occurring that we don't even know about? How many leaks, underwater leaks, are going on right now that we don't even know about? And, you know, this just underscores, as you know, you cited a whole bunch of numbers about the reserves that are there and how vast they are. You know, there is this mentality here that because the reserves are there, we've got to go get it, right? And we've got to drill every drop of oil out of the ocean floor because it's there. And it's a ridiculous notion. And, you know, the IPCC report, climate change report, tells us very, very strongly that we can't afford to access all that oil. So for so many reasons, because of the aquatic health, the risk of spills, climate, and the other impacts that fossil fuel addiction is having on this country, we need to leave that where it is, in the ground, under the water.
Scott Edwards, Brian Becker here. One quick question in our last minute. When the BP oil spill happened, I mean, there was so much drama. It was so big. The world's attention, the country's attention was focused on BP. BP had to pay compensation. The board was set up such that, you know, BP was going to have limited compensation. But absent drama like that, it would seem that public attention has shifted away, the media attention has shifted away. In our last 30 seconds or so, given the dimension of the danger, and it's not just a potential danger, the actual existing danger, what's happening? What should we do? What should you do? What are you telling people to do?
It's very interesting. There was a poll that came out, I just saw it this morning, about what motivates voters in this country, and it looked, you know, Republicans and Democrats, where the issues like the environment, like climate change, like our continuing dependency on fossil fuels is a high priority for Democratic voters. I think the number of Republicans who think that that's even a priority, that's even an issue that should be discussed, is somewhere around 11%. And for Democrats, it was 72%. We need to get everybody making this a priority issue when they go to the polls. I mean, you look at a state like North Carolina, who just got devastated in Florence and started having people talking about climate change and the media talking about climate change in a way that was very meaningful and impactful. The two senators from North Carolina are both climate deniers. So I guess what I'm saying is that climate, fossil fuel dependency, the destruction that it causes, has to be the top line issue when we put people into office that create policies, because it needs to be fixed from the top down. We need aggressive renewable energy policies. We need to leave fossil fuels in the ground. We need to address this problem immediately, or we're not going to have a planet.
It's true. That was the voice of Scott Edwards. Scott joined us from New York. He's the co-director of the Food and Water Justice Project at Food and Water Watch. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Again this week, we'll look at the worst, most misleading, and funniest headlines of the past week. Joining us from the San Francisco Bay Area is Steve Pat. He's an independent journalist whose critiques of the mainstream media have been a feature of his blog, Left Eye on the News. You can find that at lefteye.blogspot.com. And Steve tweets at Left Eye Blog. And we're also joined here in the studio by Nicole Roussel and by Walter Smolarek, our two producers and two very funny people.
That's not
thank
Walter.
You. Thank you.
Walter is not funny.
Yeah, I'm not. Sorry, listeners.
There's a great, great headline that comes from the always excellent New York Times in our most disgusting category. Let's start with that one.
It is in the most disgusting category, but, you know, if you have the right sense of humor, I found it funny as well. Again, from the New York Times, a push for safer fertilizer in Europe carries a whiff of Russian intrigue. Oh, my God.
Again, you kind of stomped all over the joke by saying in advance, it's not funny or it is funny. Or I think we have to just go straight to the next headline.
I think you're doing great, Steve.
That's Walter, who's also not funny. Okay, number two. I created a new category, by the way, called candidates for dumb and at the same time alarming headlines. And I think we have one of those. It's dumb and at the same time alarming. What is that one, Steve?
This one is about China. Beijing's nuclear option, why a U.S.-Chinese war could spiral out of control. It's from Foreign Affairs.
Okay, I want to have a quiz here amongst our esteemed panel. Why is that dumb and at the same time alarming, Walter? This is your chance to shine as a misleading headline comic.
It's dumb and alarming because I believe a war with China will already be an example of the situation spiraling out of control. Is that funny?
I don't think that was funny.
I think that was just an answer to your question. Okay.
But to be fair, making jokes about war is kind of tough.
No, he's nervous. That's why. Okay, listen.
Yeah, that's it.
The reason this is dumb and alarming at the same time is that this is the Council on Foreign Relations main magazine, Foreign Affairs, esteemed Washington policy-making institution. In the past, it was more esteemed and more powerful, less so now. But just think about the words here. Beijing's nuclear option, why a U.S.-China war could spiral out of control. If there's a war between the U.S. and China, things have already spiraled out of control. That's why it's dumb and alarming at the same time. Walter, next show you'll do better.
I believe so.
It's also misleading because the real headline should read the U.S. nuclear option, why a U.S.-China war could spiral out of control, because the author even admits, and I'm going to quote from this article, China has long stood out for its non-aggressive nuclear doctrine. China has a much smaller and simpler nuclear arsenal than its resources could have allowed. They have a no-first-use pledge, which is not the case for the United States. Really, what they're talking about is what, you know, the danger of the U.S. deciding to use nuclear weapons, not Beijing.
Brian, I think Steve Pat just beat Walter for least funny comment. I want to put it out there.
No,
I think it's true.
I'm the least funny.
It's not in the funny category.
It's not in the funny category.
Steve,
that's true.
Steve, let's keep going. redemption exists as a thing here.
That's
so
true.
We're
that's true.
Giving
it's
you another
an
shot.
Important principle.
I'm not going to say which category this headline is in. You can decide. Listeners can decide. What could kill booming U.S. economy? Socialists, White House warns. A report from the Council of Economic Advisors compares Bernie Sanders to Chairman Mao and warns that pickup trucks cost more in Sweden.
I think this probably goes in what is it most disgusting? Did I get the right category, Steve?
No. I think this is a dumb headline. It's not alarming, but it's a dumb headline. But it's what it says, basically, and what the Trump administration and the Trump team are doing is they're bringing out the old bugaboo of communism and socialism is the main problem. The real reason socialism is gaining popularity is because there are so many people who don't have good jobs. There are so many people who are sick and tired of racism. There are so many people in America, the quote, richest country in the world, whose relatives are imprisoned for long periods of time because there's a system of mass incarceration. The reason socialism is growing as a concept, and it certainly is that people can't afford to live. Even if you have a job, you can't afford rent. The reason socialism is growing is that in New York City, one out of every 10 public school students, that's more than 114,000 students, are homeless. That's true. That's a literally true fact. That's why socialism is growing. And if this is the booming economy where all of those phenomena are in fact existing, low wages, not good jobs, homeless kids going to school in large numbers, then it's actually not a booming economy except for some sector of the population. Steve Pat, where do you want to go next?
Well, how about this one? Five novelists imagine Trump's next chapter, again from the New York Times. And this is about, it says Trump's next chapter. It means Mueller's next chapter. It's because they haven't had any actual evidence of collusion yet in the Mueller investigation. The New York Times decided the best thing to do was to commission five fiction writers to write what might happen in this investigation. Kind of desperate, I would say.
There's another headline here that I want to turn to. Again, it's kind of in our worst and most disgusting category, and it has to do with Yemen. Of course, Saudi Arabia has been in the news, but let's talk about this headline, Steve Pat.
Sure. Again, from the New York Times, Saudi Arabia's invisible war. The Khashoggi crisis has called attention to a largely overlooked Saudi-led war in Yemen. Now, we actually had a very similar headline to this last week in the Washington Post. This time it's the New York Times. And again, whose fault do they think it is that this war has been largely overlooked and is invisible? It's the New York Times and the Washington Post's fault that's invisible, not, you know, not us, not their listeners or their readers.
Yeah, no, I hear you on that. I mean, that's, Nicole, that's completely true. I mean, it's as if the New York Times wasn't a party to all of this. The party to all of this ignorance.
That's right.
And enforced ignorance. I mean, John, we've been talking about this every day. If Sputnik News can cover it, if Loudoun & Clear can cover it, why has it suddenly become apparent to the New York Times?
Well, is the New York Times all the news that's fit to print or all the news that fits they print?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, we're seeing headlines about Yemen and Al Jazeera. We're seeing headlines about Yemen in RT. There are a number of other outlets who are covering this, but not the mainstream media here in the U.S., absolutely. But, you know, just yesterday when we talked about this on the show earlier in the week, and then just yesterday we had a headline about, you know, the Saudi-led coalition killed at least 21 people by bombing literal just fruit and vegetable stands near the port of Hodeida. I mean, this is real serious, you know, consequential mass killing of civilians.
And, you know, the argument that, well, people don't want to hear about that. Like, it, in other words, that they're just responding to, you know, what the market, quote unquote, wants in the United States. I think that's ridiculous. I mean, if people knew, if people saw the images, if people, you know, if it was on their screens all the time, yeah, I think any human being with a conscience would be absolutely, you know, wanting to know every development that's going on.
And it's completely political and selective. Like, when the U.S.-led coalition or the U.S.-Iraqi-led coalition was trying to destroy ISIS in Mosul and they were bombing every day, we heard nothing about the humanitarian crisis. But when the Syrian government, which is on the other side of the Americans, when they were clearing Aleppo or East Aleppo of the same group, ISIS, then every day it was about how it's a humanitarian catastrophe because there are aerial strikes on an urban environment.
I think the only reason that the American public even knows anything about the Syrian conflict, which I think is not much, frankly, is to your point, Brian, that, you know, it's been selectively covered. But because there are two sides to what's going on, it has been selectively covered. In Yemen, it's pretty much just the Saudi-led coalition just dropping a ton of bombs and we just don't hear anything about it.
I want Steve Pat to go to the issue of who the Justice Department is charging for midterm elections. It's an amazing headline.
OK, here's the headline. Justice Department charges Russian woman with interference in midterm elections. And I put this under most misleading because they didn't charge her with interference in midterm elections. That's a false headline. They charged her with conspiracy to do so. And conspiracy is one of these charges that means they can't actually prove that a crime occurred or that there even is such a crime as, you know, creating a fake persona on Facebook or tweeting about NFL protests under a false name. All they have to do is you talked with some people. So conspiracy is really a fake crime. And they did not charge her with interference in the elections.
Steve, Pat, give us one more headline.
OK, I put this in the category of most jaw-dropping headline. It's from ABC News. A look back at Trump comments perceived by some as encouraging violence. And I say perceived by some. Are you kidding me? This is a guy who's talked about knocking the crap out of protesters and punching them in the face. But according to ABC News, these are comments which are, quote unquote, perceived by some as encouraging violence. It's really astonishing.
I'm really glad you mentioned that. Remember during the 2016 campaign, he said in the good old days, we used to take these people out on stretchers.
Exactly.
We're going to have to leave it there, folks. We were joined from the San Francisco Bay Area by Steve Pat. He's an independent journalist whose critiques of the mainstream media have been a feature of his blog, Left Eye on the News. Steve tweets at Left Eye Blog, and you can go there to catch up on all the headlines that we couldn't get to. We were also joined here in the studio by Sputnik News analysts and producers Nicole Roussel and Walter Smolarek. Well, we are completely out of time. You've been listening to Loud and Clear. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. And you can follow us on Twitter at Loud Clear Radio. You can also hear us every day, Monday through Friday, from 4 to 6 p.m. on 105.5 FM and 1390 AM in the Washington, D.C. area. You can hear us at SputnikNews.com and as a podcast at iTunes, iHeartRadio, Spreaker, and Spotify. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We'll see you next time.
Loud and Clear.